Hey everybody, I'm Bobby Salveson.
And I'm Michael Monaco, and together we are the Hazmat Guys, connecting the Hazmat community near and far with knowledge, insight, and real-world examples in an effort to make your job just a little bit easier and safer.
Now, let's take a minute to hear from today's sponsors. Hey, Mike, pop quiz. What is the standard go-to method for emergency decon?
That's pretty easy. Wet decon, right?
Well, you know, you're not the only one that may be thinking that, but it's actually dry decon.
No. How many times have I heard dilution is the solution to pollution?
Actually, too many. And that's the issue. Makes sense if you think about it. Without the use of water, we don't need to spend extra time setting up traditional showers or pools, and there's no wastewater afterwards. And you're not going to freeze anybody to death if it's below 60 degrees.
Check out firstlinetech.com/drydecon. Firstline Technology has a whole webpage dedicated to the methodology and links to plenty of dry decon resources. See for yourself why dry decon with FiberTech should be your go-to immediate decon solution.
You know, it's time to rethink your level A protection. Multi-threat suits made of lightweight Gore Chempak Ultra Barrier Fabric are part of the most functional non-encapsulated level A ensembles that bring an essential modernization to hazmat PPE. Certified NFPA 1994 Class 1 suits with Gore Chempak Ultra Barrier Fabric offer unencumbered movement, increased range of motion, improved peripheral visibility, excellent dexterity, and reduced heat stress so you can stay engaged longer. You can learn more at GoreTexProfessional.com. Let's get to the show.
Hello out there in Hazmat land. This is Michael Monaco. This is episode 363 of the Hazmat Guys podcast. I'm here always with Bob. Hello, Bob.
Hello. Hi. I got my little goatee thing going on.
I see that. And you've got the gray retirement thing going on.
Yeah. The wife says, boy, I'm a little gray. I'm like, you know, shut up.
It wasn't that long ago your mustaches were coming in black as night.
Dude, the mustache comes in like pitch black. And then like around the chin, the chinny chin chins, it's all like white.
You ever see the movie Joe Dirt?
Yes. Oh, I love it.
The episode where he's like, they're like, do you shave like that? And he's like, no, it just naturally grows that way.
Yeah, it just... That's
my facial hair. It naturally grows with like these movies. Like giant patches missing out of my face.
Like Team America. Did you ever see the one with the marionettes where they tape all the, they glue like the hair to the faces?
So we got kind of a cool episode today. I think it's a cool episode. It's an extension of two other episodes. And I really like these because this is what the podcast is supposed to be. It's supposed to be a conversation back and forth between events and things that are happening to learn from each other. And to actually have a multi back and forth is kind of cool. But before we do that, do we want to have any conversation about where we're going to be in the next couple of months?
Oh, yeah. Well, you can catch us tonight, which is the night we're recording, October 27th, which if you're listening to this, it was yesterday. But it's every fourth Thursday of every month, 1900 hours Eastern Standard Time. And you can go to hazmat.com/happy for the happy hour and actually sit and talk with us and chew on incidents or what you're thinking, what you got a question. Throw it right to us. We're here on the air with you and not recorded. So it's a great thing. A lot of pluses on that one so far.
I've literally learned something on every happy hour. I walk away with something. So there's good stuff to learn from everybody out there. It's a good time.
Yeah. And I think the only conference left this year is the Hazmat Instructor Conference, which is coming up rather shortly in another week or two, down in California, down in Florida. But if you have a conference that's coming up and you want us to mention it on the show and all types of newsletters and other things, give us a call or give me an email at bob@thehazmatguys.com. And also our new sponsor, mypatriotcigars.com. You can use the promo code THMG for 15% off of your next and every single order. Yum, yum. Get that smoke on.
Yeah, those cigars help put hair back on my head. Yeah.
They certainly did.
They are not FDA approved. That is not an actual endorsement of medical advice.
He didn't even smoke it. He just rubbed it on his head.
Just,
and that was
rubbed it on my head.
Wand.
All my hair is coming back. So today, we're going to continue to use initials. And even though there are department names in the email, we're not going to use them because that's not in any way, shape, or form what we're about. We just want the basic information. So if we were to recall last week's episode, there was a Facebook post on our private Facebook group about the R-404A, I believe was the was the incident. And so we responded on the Facebook post, which we always will. And then we decided to have a follow-up episode about it because it's an interesting kind of, you know, we understand that it's going – what's the best way to say this? It's taking – the understanding the meters to the next level.
Yeah.
Right.
It's not technician level. This is just good foundational understanding of a meter. Again, we've said this many times. It's like, I know guys that know how much the battery weighs. I don't care about that stuff.
Right. Right.
But this is a functional operations level.
Yeah.
Understanding of how metering works.
Because as a mission specific operations is the operations is the lowest level that somebody's trained at with the meters. So every firefighter out there should be able to interpret what's happening in their meter. So we got an email back from that episode, and we're going to read the email and discuss a few of the things that are brought up in the email, and then have a conversation about something that Bob brought up in the email that we don't ever talk about.
Right. We've probably mentioned it maybe once or twice in passing. We'll get to that. But this is, I got to say, for my man out here, Jay.
JR, baby.
This is pretty freaking good because he broke down. All right. So now if you want to learn what the hell we're talking about, stop. Go back to episode 352, and then listen to episode 362. Where we respond to his response. And now he broke this down and is just basically checking his math, I would say.
Right.
So do you want me to start reading through this?
You want to do the first paragraph? I'll do the second.
Yeah. So, all right. Let me catch up to where it is. So we mentioned... he did not listen to the original podcast, so right. He didn't know, because that was kind of like one of the jokes that we said about the flammable refrigerant podcast. They have when we were mentioning in the last episode, we were talking about the 5-gas, and it is indeed, this is the typical slang, is when somebody says a 5-gas meter, they're saying the standard 4-gas plus PID.
Right.
But as we said last episode, there are people that say 5-gas, and they mean, oh, I have 4 gases plus 1 gas.
Right, like a CO2, right, chlorine, something along those lines.
Right. So just when somebody says something like that, be leery of assuming that you know what they're talking about, because the addition of a PID gives you a huge capability, and if it was a single gas, it does not give you any capability unless that gas is in play.
Right.
But there's no enhancement there. So right. And the location that the staff claimed the leak originated was completely frozen over, like auto refrigeration ice block.
Which on a leak, so if we often see the ice block in the liquid portion of a compressed liquefied gas, right? Where
you can see it in the hot, in the pressure side, the gas side.
In too. The vapor side. Yeah, you definitely can, but it takes a lot longer.
Yeah, absolutely. Unless it's Florida and it's a 148% humidity.
That's true. That's true.
Or they're throwing, extinguisher cans of water on that leak. You can get one of those stalactite type operations with ice buildup.
Right.
And then finally, and then we're gonna get into the math of this thing because it's kind of an important thing. And I actually might share the math, just clipping off the right spots so we don't give anything away. But the math is pretty important because it will drive us to kind of the takeaway for today's show. And all mechanicals inside the freezer were turned off, but the mechanicals inside the refrigerator were operational.
I don't exactly know what that means.
Me neither. And I'm not an HVAC and neither are you. And I think there might be two different controllers where in like your fridge, I think they both work off the same compressor pump. They don't have two separate, but I'm assuming the bigger pumps would have two separate zones.
Remember he said that it was a freezer inside a refrigerator.
Ah.
So he's saying the mechanicals inside the freezer were turned off. The mechanics inside the refrigerator space, they were still operational. Okay, that's right.
Okay.
Key part of that, freezer in a fridge.
Okay. So, while you're starting to talk about these numbers, I'm going to work on putting it up on the screen for all of our premium, fancy people.
So one of the reasons that he is replying back is he did all this math and he kind of wanted to verify, hey, listen, like, is this math correct? Am I missing something? So in the episode 62, we had talked about the breakdown of the R404A and why you can have a mixture where a portion of that mixture, 100% of that gas is flammable. Read flammable, a portion of your LEL on the meter, yet in your research, you would see non-flammable gas, which, it kind of makes you, you look at it and you think non-flammable gas doesn't have an LEL, doesn't have a UEL. Immediately, we've always been kind of taught like, well, then I don't have anything that's combustible. So he starts kind of breaking this down and he says R404A is comprised of three gases. It's R431, 52%, R125, 44%, and R341, about 4%. R341 at 52% is the only gas with flammability. He's 100% right. The other two are absolutely not flammable. Now, we had made a quick assumption that maybe it was close to a third because, you were of the LELs that we were getting. Our napkin off the top of our head math wasn't correct. It was 52% of the material is flammable. Its UEL and LEL are 7.4 and 18.8. So if we were to have R43 alpha standalone all by itself, that's its upper and lower explosive limits.
Yep.
All right. So their monitor, now he even goes into correction factors. The monitor is calibrated to methane at 17%, which indicates a combustible gas volume of 8,500 parts per million. He said he found this by finding 17% of 50,000. So
yep.
I don't know. He hasn't done any kind of conversion factors yet.
Not yet.
The LEL of R404A is 7.4 by volume, which makes its LEL in parts per million 74,000. Okay.
Right.
Which that all makes sense. 8,500 divided by 7,400 gives us
74,000.
What's up?
74,000.
What did I say?
7,400.
Yeah, I'm dyslexic. So 8,500 divided by 74,000 gives us 15% LEL of R404A.
All right, let me reread that because I don't know why I had the dyslexic guy reading this. 85,000 divided by 74,000 gives you 11.5% LEL of the R404A. Right? So now let's just pause there for a second because there are a couple of things here. And just for you guys that are at home doing your back of the mirror napkin kind of thing, is that when you have three gases that are combined, I'm sorry, three liquids that are combined, actually, no, they're gases.
They are gases, yeah.
Right. They're all gases. So you have three gases combined. This is typically outside of what we think in hazmat, this is one of the weaknesses of hazmat specialists or technicians, is that we always think single commodity. We always think, okay, it's pure ammonia, it's pure chlorine, it's pure. It's not like that. And this is a perfect example of this, right? So if I was on the street and you said, hey, I have these three gases mixed, here's what I would want to know about those three gases. First, I want to know, what is the boiling point? Right, which is loosely tied, it's pretty tightly tied, but is tied to molecular weight. And why do I want to know the boiling point? Because it tells me the vapor pressure. So if you're looking at these three gases and you have one that has an exceptionally high vape pressure, which one do you think is the first one to come out of the pipe? The high vape pressure one, right?
Right.
Well, in this mixture, we have to assume, and now again, we're assuming, this is incorrect assuming, that each one has the same vapor pressure, okay? But because the proportions are different, you got to think about the surface area of the whole jug of this crap, right?
Right.
If I only have R134A, only gets 4% of the surface area, well, it can only produce 4% of the vapors. So the guys with heaviest concentration in solution are the guys that are able to put the most vapor out.
Right.
So now you couple that with their vapor pressure. You correlate that with the vape pressure, right? Because forget the vape pressure up to that point. I have this bucket and I have 50% of it is one gas. Well, 50% of that surface area is that gas, is that liquid.
Right.
And it's producing 50% of all the vapors that are coming out. However, let's say this, the 4% one has a crazy vape pressure. Well, it could struggle and push out and squeak by that 50% guy.
Initially, until it runs out.
Until it runs out, because right. It's only 4%. So this is interesting because it up to this point, there's no indication of vapor pressures. Do you think that matters?
Hey, listeners, the Hazmat Guys have some great news for you and your organization. We are really stepping up our brand of in-person training in addition to the great content you get on demand. Now, we know what you're thinking, but this is already incredibly great stuff, and how could it possibly get better? All I can say is wait until we're in front of you. When we gather the best of the best from across this planet and even beyond and assemble an instructional cadre that is seriously second to none. And now we have a ton of ways to help you, your team, or your organization get to a level that makes everybody proud. From subscriptions, on-demand, hybrid methods to full in-person goodness. You can contact me, Bob, at thehazmatguys.com to schedule a call and find a solution that works for you. And every participant of an in-person class gets a free one-year premium subscription, which sounds pretty good. So contact me at bob@thehazmatguys.com and get some more information.
I would say at some point there's a couple of things that are going to matter with the math. All right. Definitely the vapor pressure, I believe, is one of them. Another thing that's one of them is that, you know, we turn around and he says that, let me see here, R143 alpha, 52%. Well, being a chemistry guy, Bob, what is your first thought when somebody says 50% of a material? Because mine is, well, is that by weight? Is that by volume? Is that by pressure? You know, like what are we measuring 52% of exactly? And that changes everything because you turn around and you do 52%, but then you're dropping down to parts per million. So we don't actually know. Like if we were to take a million parts per million of the substance, is 52%, does that mean I'll have 520,000 parts per million? If it's atom for atom or mole for mole, then yes. But if it's by weight, and let's say R143 alpha is twice as heavy as R124,
good point.
you know, then those percentages could be off. And I don't know what the weights are, and I don't know how it was calculated, but he runs down a little bit later and he's saying these are the numbers I got, but how come I'm not getting any kind of oxygen displacement, right? With these numbers, I should have seen some kind of oxygen displacement, and I'm not. So he's wondering why his math is off.
So, all right, there's four lines. Let me, because I do want to get to the oxygen displacement, because I think that's where a lot of this, the knowledge comes from. I think this is a big point. It says that if 8,500 parts per million represents 52% of the leak, then the other 48% of, you know, obviously coming up to 100 of the leak is comprised of non-flammable gases. I concur. Calculate the volume. Again, he's assuming it's volume, not weight, because that would make changes there. Right. By multiplying 8,500 parts per million by 48% and dividing that number by 52 to get 7,846 parts per million of other gas concentration. Add those together, you get the total leak volume of 16,346 parts per million. You divide that by 50,000, which is what it takes to displace oxygen. 1%, and you get an oxygen displacement of 0.33%.
Right. And the math on all of that is correct.
I agree with it.
I agree with the math, right? So sometimes in chemistry and physics, we can be on the wrong path, but be doing the correct math and lead to a different answer, right? So like another thing that isn't here, even though, and he said it, but he didn't account for it, is he's saying that my gas meter is calculated to methane, but he didn't do a correction factor. And when you're dealing, you know, the reason that we do correction factors is because different chemicals are going to burn hotter or colder during the chemical reaction, right? Different amounts of heat are given off. And since the CAD bead sensor works off of a change in resistance due to heat, that's where our correction factors comes from, right? I can have a material, and let's go back to, let's say, a one for one molecule, or, you know, I have one mole of methane burning, and it might produce a heat of, I'm going to totally make up this number, 5 BTUs, right? And I have one mole of R143 alpha, and when that goes through its oxidation cycle, it produces 10 BTUs of heat. Well, mm-hmm. that one mole is going to indicate to the meter that I have twice as much product as I actually do. So that's where a correction factor comes in. And in numbers that we're dealing with, like 0.33%, right, which technically should be like a 0.2, 0.1, you know, that kind of a displacement on our O2, the math, that little bit of math, I'm not saying it does, I'm saying it could make a difference.
I do want to pull out, because I'm reading a little further down, and I want to correct myself. He says, the one I believe to have disproven, his theory, was the volatility of the refrigerants in the blend could differ, causing more volatile gases to dissipate at a different rate over time, leaving less volatile compounds behind in different concentrations than the original mixture. I think we said that in the last episode, and he said he thought he had to crack the case, but with this theory, he checked the vapor pressure of the main gases, and they were similar enough not to really account for it. And he said that the R143A was 160 psi, not even a millimeters of mercury. We're talking about PSI.
PSI, yeah.
And R125 was 175. So is there a difference? Yeah, but that's negligible. Unless it was like one was like, you know, 0.2 millimeters of mercury and the other one was like 6,000 PSI. That's a big difference.
Right.
This is really not. You're still in the same ballpark. So, yeah, my apologies. So here's where it comes down to, and this is – where I went back with, you know, I replied back to him, is the question was, why didn't he see a oxygen displacement?
Right, because he's saying with his math, right, and it says, the other less exciting theory is that the monitors we use are just missing the displacement due to the relatively small 0.33 with the monitor replicability yeah. listed as 0.7 for its O2 meter. So he's saying we should have seen something. What is he saying? He's believing a 0.7% fluctuation. I would have thought with 1,600 parts per million, you're going to see a 1.5 displacement.
1.5%
on oxygen? Point one five.
Right, which that makes sense. And now comes the little thing that I sent back to him is that there is a, and I'm saying this with big air quotes, there is a feature that the vast majority of metering manufacturers employ into their specifically oxygen sensor is something called dead banding.
And what is dead banding? When should we be considering it? And how is it useful or not useful to us?
I say it all the time. It's a feature or a bug. I'm very confused by it. I'll give you both sides of the playing field, is that we program our guys to say, if oxygen goes down, if oxygen is being displaced, you have 50,000 parts per million, something here, and you should be concerned about that. I get it. So if it goes down 0.1, I have 5,000. And if I have something that's 5,000 parts per million, there's shit out there that's so toxic, 5 parts per million will get you. So 5,000 parts per million should be a concern. However, the oxygen sensor is an electrochemical sensor, and it is affected by temperature, humidity, operator, age,
pressure, altitude,
elevation, pressure. Oh, right. All these things are going to make this thing kind of waver a little bit back and forth. And now you put this into our properly programmed operations or technician level guy, and he's been told, if that thing moves, you have some death over your shoulder.
Yeah. There's a lot of product in the air.
Right? And they're programmed for that. So now if I say, okay, we got 0.1, or in your case, you said 0.15.
0.15, right.
Right? That's information I would like to know about. However, what if it's naturally fluctuating 0.1, 0.2? And there's nothing here. There's literally nothing. You're out in the middle of a field. It's like the Windows screensaver. You're in the middle of a blue sky,
yep,
field of grain, and you get 0.2. Well, obviously, I have a gas around me.
Right.
No.
Something's going on.
Right. So what they do is they tell the software in the meter to pretty much blank out, keep it on 20.9%, even if you're up to, depending on your manufacturer, 0.2 plus or minus, which means you have a 0.4 gap of what you're seeing,
which is
20,000 parts per million.
Yeah, 20,000 parts per million.
Of a blind spot. Like, you're in a car and you have a 20,000 parts per million blind spot
on each side. So really, it's 40,000.
No. It's 10 and 10.
Well, it's displacement 0.5. And oxygen, you know, 10 in one direction, right? 0.2 going up for.
And 0.2 going down.
And 0.2 going down, right.
Right. So that's 10 and 10 is 20 of spot you can't get. So was it possible that his 0.15 percent of oxygen being displaced was hidden by the software? I would say it's very possible.
It is very possible.
You know, and so now comes back the option. Okay, so let's say I don't want this feature. Can you change the software settings so that you can turn that off? I believe you can. Depending on your make and model, you can do that. However, when you put that meter into the hands of a properly programmed, and I'm saying that very facetiously, properly programmed operations or technician, and they are programmed to say, if this thing moves, you have something, they have to understand that the sensor naturally moves left and right all over the place.
Even age, like we know O2 drift is a thing in and of itself, and that's with the dead banding going on.
Yeah. Yeah, so these sensors, there is no perfect sensor. And anybody that tells you, any manufacturer, any salesman that tells you, our meter will solve all your ills, they're selling you something. There is no perfect meter, or else it would have been invented already.
Right, right.
It's not even theoretically possible.
Which is why, and, you know, listen, we give kudos where kudos is given. The manufacturer that makes the high pressure GCM, not GCM, 908. 908, right? 908 devices, when they teach their stuff, their whole thought process in adding that meter to the cadre is this is a single solitary tool in a vast toolbox.
Yes.
And you, when coupled with this meter and coupled with this meter and coupled with this meter, it helps you get a better picture. And I was so impressed with that company for approaching their meter in that direction, because they're one of the few that really embraced that concept of like, you know, use the flaws in the meter to help help you get a bigger picture, and use the flaws in other meters to help you get a bigger picture. It was a great concept. So,
yeah. So I think, listen, I know some of you guys probably fell asleep with the math part, but this is an important piece, is that understanding the limitations of your meter and the whys. And then when you say, wait a second, that doesn't make sense, what's the pros and cons of that feature that you didn't even know about last 20 minutes ago? Is this a good or bad thing? And the answer is, I'm shaking my head yes, and I'm saying no, because it's, I don't know.
Yeah, it is kind of just one of those, it is what it is. And for the 1% of the time that you're going to scratch your head, most people don't even care about it. Right. Or it's kind of one of those like, all right, that doesn't make sense. And they're like, whatever. And they walk away from it.
Right.
But it is good to understand, because if you do end up getting, let's say you do get the rare instance where you have an incident commander that has, you know, some kind of metering experience, and they turn around and they go, yeah, but that doesn't make sense, I should get this, then you're stuck not having answers.
Right.
And we always want to be able to have an answer for an incident commander.
Yeah. I mean, this one's a little bit deeper, but listen, he doesn't have to listen to this episode. You obviously listen because you care.
Right.
You know, and so you just got a tool for your toolbox of your argument toolbox of when somebody asks you something like, why is this happening? This might be your answer.
And it would be interesting. Now, I wonder with our halogenated hydrocarbon meter, something like, and this is something I don't know, I'm literally questioning it in my head as we say it, R404A, if I walk down there with my halogenated hydrocarbon meter, is it going to pick up an accurate R404A reading? And is it going to say, okay, I have this material, I'm looking for this material, or is it just going to do a generic, I'm going to take a weight or, you know, a frequency that's sort of in the middle of all these and give you a roundabout?
I think it's going to do the general.
I think it's going to do a general too.
It's going to be like a combined the gas law kind of averaging kind of mathematic thing.
Right.
I think most of that stuff is just correction values, that when you set it to different things on the screen, it just does a correction value for you. But I don't know if that's true. I don't know if the new technology has that kind of stuff.
It would be interesting to then take that meter in a situation like this, get the exact parts per million that our halogenated hydrocarbon is reading, and then compare that with the math and see what our differences are.
All right. Well, good talk. Well, that wraps up another episode of the Hazmat Guys. You can find us at Facebook, Twitter, and our YouTube channel. And don't be afraid to use that like or follow button. Or
you can sign up for even more content from us at thehazmatguys.com. Here, you can subscribe so that we can connect you to even more great stuff. Your support is going to help us improve and build this awesome community even more.
Yeah, and if you want to get to the next level, you won't want to miss our premium content. Our specialist level provides you with access to our entire catalog of shows, which is now over 300, an exclusive Facebook group, premium video with no ads, and so much more. Also, check the Hazmat Guys University link on our website.
And don't forget, we are always interested in hearing about incidences or calls that you have experienced. We may bring you on the show to share that story.
reach us at feedback@thehazmatguys.com.
And remember, folks, don't just get on the job, get into the job.